Well, good afternoon, everyone. How are you feeling? Good, good. My name is Amir Parsa. I'm here at the museum as I work as a lecturer and also as currently the project manager of what is called the Alzheimer's Project. Have you heard about it? No? Okay. Well, we're going to get into it a little bit at the end of the lecture because, as you'll see, this entire lecture is inspired by what we do in that project and by a program at the museum that's called Meet Me at MoMA. But at the same time, that program is inspired and informed by a lot of the philosophical and aesthetic concerns and issues that are going to come up throughout this lecture. I just want to, before starting, because we very often don't do that, I just want to say thank you to a couple of people. Of course, top of the list is Francesca Rosenberg, whose birthday it was also 3 days ago. She is a director of the Community and Access Programs and the inspiration behind a lot of the programs we do there. Also, Laurel Humble, who is irreplaceable in her help creating these PowerPoints endlessly. And Laura Bayless, who's not here yet, but who coordinates all the brown bags in case you come to all of them, okay? So I just wanna leave this slide up another 30 seconds. I think you've been sort of looking at it without necessarily knowing what is represented. Does anybody know what is represented? Don't say it. If you know, don't say, okay? That's what not everybody knows, right? That's one of my points. But everybody understands art and dementia, representations, abstractions, actions. Everybody's familiar with that, sort of the meaning of that. But not everybody knows what that is an image of. And that's part of the point. What I want to just tell you as in lieu of a quick introduction, throughout this lecture, what is really interesting to me and I think really fascinating throughout is to touch upon the ways that we've conceptualized, thought about what dementia, madness, insanity, all of these terms, as fluid, as uncertain as they are, and how they've affected the way that we've perceived the world and acted upon those perceptions, created programs, interned people, taken their freedoms away, not allowed them to do things, or the opposite. All of these are based on representations, perceptions, very often on fragile ground, right? We don't have, I'm going to be limited in terms of what we talk about, in terms of our categories, by number one, the time that we have, about 50 minutes or to an hour. And the other way I'm going to limit us is by just sticking to the modern and contemporary time frame. So from the 1880s all the way to now. It would be fascinating to look at the ways we've categorized these things all the way back to the Middle Ages and before. But we're not going to do that today. So the whole thing is about really a typology of relationships between dementia, what we now currently call dementia, and all its incarnations to come and the previous ones, and this very nebulous, hard-to-define arena that we call art. All right? The one person that remains a constant throughout the 100 years that we will be covering is this fellow. Anybody familiar with him? A doctor, right? Everybody's seen a doctor? Has anybody never gone to a doctor? No? Okay. So we're all familiar. It's kind of funny, but at the same time, one of the points that I want to touch on is that this is a representation of an entity, of a being whose real version we have come into contact with, right? Of course, this is a caricaturized version, a very grotesque version. We're not going to get too much into analysis of single works of art because obviously it could take us forever, but a very cold stare, not warm, not welcoming, right? Not somebody you particularly want to go see. He's got all of his tools behind him. This room that he seems to be occupying doesn't feel like your very friendly doctor's room. It almost looks like a torture chamber in a way, right? You got these tools, you have this brick wall, this chair, the composition, frontal, obviously his overweightedness and the way that it covers all the frame. It communicates a certain take on this particular person. Obviously, it's a representation, right? Oil on canvas, and it's by Otto Dix from 1926. I mention this because this figure and his opinions and the way that he's perceived it actually really affects the way we think about the issues that we're going to think about. And we'll touch on this again later on. The first category that I really want to you know, touch on relatively briefly, is insanity captured, right? And I want to start us with a photograph. The reason that I really wanted to actually bring a photograph in, although we could have brought a lot of different things, is that the form of the photograph and our expectations from the photographic medium really go well with the content of what happens, or what used to happen in our categorizations of people. First of all, this notion of insanity, and this, by the way, is called Insane Asylum, Ohio. It's a gelatin silver print, black and white, by Jerry Cook from 1945. You can very easily see, right? First of all, the mood, the starkness, the tonalities, the darkness that is prevalent all over. You can't see faces. You can barely see emotions. It's a great photograph from purely photographic terms, right? In the ways that light actually creates the entire image. Photography is all about light and its writing. And in this case, it's literal. The light coming in is actually providing us with what we see within it. And what do we see? We actually see a man standing against the wall in a way that's completely abnormal, in a way that we would classify as kind of crazy, right, in quotation marks. Unexpected behaviors, not normal behaviors. The other ones seem to be wandering or just standing around aimlessly without any purpose in life. And I think the reason that this is very powerful, number one, it's an actual representation of a real scene. Right, so it's literally captured. But the second reason is captured through the photographic medium. And our relationship with photography still to this day remains that there is a reality and that the photographic medium is par excellence capable of capturing that reality by being very, very close or actually being a copy of it. Right? In another way, it's capturing it. The photograph itself engages in the act of capturing. Very commonly done, the notion that there are people, they have a particular condition, they have a particular illness, and I'm going to capture that reality, right? But at the same time, what we really need to realize is that the photograph, like any other medium, is an artifice. It's cropped. There's a choice in terms of composition. There's a lot of choices being made in terms of focus, the distance of the subject to the people, what you're actually portraying. So you are, at the same time, creating a sense of what we're seeing. You're creating a reality as much as you're representing what already exists. And I think that's the essence of photography, and it captures it here. But of course, a category that's much more prevalent and much more mythological is the one of the artist as madman. I'm not saying that this is a fact, that artists are madmen, of course, but the notion that they exist, some people might disagree and think that they are, but the issue being that this is a mythology that really is prevalent within our culture, one that we actually like to sometimes propagate. These days, they're less madmen than they are divas, right? Particular behaviors, particular expectations. And of course, we can't talk about this mythology without talking about Vincent, who's seen the exhibition that's up right now. All right, I have to bring him up. I want to touch really quickly on this work in particular, because it's quintessentially Vincent, number one. And simultaneously, it's a great work of art from a painterly perspective. Right? He actually makes your eye kind of go up this hill, creates a perspective with a tree. Compositionally, two-thirds, three-fourths of this painting is the sky, so you can't escape the fact that the sky is dominant. The sky is what is actually the center and the focus of this painting. But simultaneously, there's a lot of great contrast here. Here, you have bright colors, not what you expect at night. You have swirls, you have dynamism, you have movement. You have a particular way of representing the sky, a way that nobody else was engaged in, and nobody since has really done, right? A lot of, and if you've ever seen the real one, obviously, there's a great texture, there's a great three-dimensionality to this painting, and it evokes emotion, charge, a lot of passion. All of that is within the painting. We don't need to know anything about this person called Vincent van Gogh, right? But once we know about him, we make those associations, and the associations are, of course, he did this when he was in Saint-Rémy in June of 1889, voluntarily went there. We know the myth associated with him. He committed suicide. He cut off his ear. You wouldn't want to, the number of times people come in front of this painting and say, well, you know, he's the crazy painter, right? He cut off his ear. This, the very fact that all of this is myth is very relevant, right? I'm talking about the impression, the perception of the artist as a madman. And what's more interesting is that people after the fact, and even during, but even more after, have gone into what Van Gogh's condition actually was. And a lot of things have come up, like frontotemporal schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, you know, chemistry that was going on in his brain. I had once a group of Dutch doctors in the galleries, right? And they knew the whole medical history of Vincent. And they were telling me, it was fascinating, and you can actually read this in other literature, that the particular drug that Vincent was given to treat what was diagnosed as his illness at the time made him see stars in the sky in particular ways, right? And so he's just replicating what he sees. That, in my opinion, doesn't actually matter that much. What matters is whatever it was within him as an artist, a very studied artist, a very knowledgeable artist, to actually take his vision and to force upon us, the viewers, to see the world in a different way, to associate the stars with a different shape, to see in the sky movement, dynamism, to see the dominance of nature, to see the fluidity, to actually feel the wind, something that you can't represent. Was all of this due to just one thing? I don't think so. It's a much more complex than that. It's a series of experiences, a wealth of knowledge, and of course, the particular chemical and biological condition of your being, right? Another fellow that you've probably heard less of, anybody heard of Antonin Artaud, A-R-T-A-U-D? And Artaud is a very fascinating case because he was a performer, a theatrical person. He wrote actually what is now recognized as very much of a classic in the performing and theatrical arts, The Theater of Cruelty, a manifesto full of rage and anger and passion and warmth and a very particular take on life, which is really implemented now in the theater world in many different variations. Very powerful. But he was also diagnosed at the age of 41 and also taken to asylums of different kinds and spent some time from 1943 to 1946 at this place called Rodez, R-O-D-E-Z. So his freedom was taken away and he went through electroshocks of all sorts of kinds for reasons that are very debatable. Right? It was completely unnecessary if you want to, you know, kind of look into this. But it was his condition, his situation as a man in society that was troubling. So the thing to think about, why do we categorize people in particular ways? Why does their behavior, their abnormalcy, their way of seeing the world in different ways, why is that so relevant? Unless somebody's dangerous to others, why does it bother us? Why does it bother elements, organs of society, right? And this was what was exactly happening with Artaud. And what happened in Rodez was not that a flow of creativity came through him. He was actually very depressed, blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, he committed himself. Because of the electroshocks, because he was being possessed, literally, he committed himself to what is kind of called an absolute desire to repossess and to reclaim his entire being, body and mind. And so there's a lot of focus on body. And I wanted to show you this self-portrait from 1946 because the lines, the gauntness, the weight of the existential angst that is present is very much there. And I actually want to read you a few lines from a poem that he wrote called The Human Face. And he actually wrote something about Van Gogh and called Van Gogh the society's suicidal son, the person who committed suicide because of society. So he writes, "For thousands and thousands of years, indeed, the human face has talked and breathed, and one is under the impression still that it has not begun to say what it is and what it knows. Not a single painter in the history of art, from Holbein to Ingres, whom I know of, has succeeded in making it talk, this face of man. Holbein's portraits or those of Ingres are but thick walls that explain nothing of the ancient mortal architecture that buttresses the arches of eyelids or tails into the cylindrical tunnel of the two mural cavities of the ears. Van Gogh only could make of the human head, a portrait which was the bursting flare of a throbbing, exploded heart, his own. Van Gogh's head with a felt hat renders null and void all the attempts at abstract painting which can be made after him until the end of all eternities. So we have these diagnoses. We used to have them. The current research only confirms that a lot of people, when they were doing those diagnoses, obviously didn't have enough material, didn't have enough knowledge, were not differentiating in interesting and intelligent and respectful ways. Everybody got dumped into one thing or another. Current research, as interesting as it is, one of its confirmations is of that. And so what were those behaviors? Lack of coherence, lack of repeating the same thing over and over again, not understanding the consequences of your action, being focused and concentrated to extreme degrees on particular passions, being savage in the way that you act. And all of that, as uncategorizable and unidentifiable as it was, made people think of this term, crazy, mad, as this nebulous series of actions, which allowed us to use it as a great metaphor for all of those things that we continue to do that are not deemed mad officially, but that artists obviously thought of. And that's why I have this section called Madness as Metaphor. And there's one event in humankind that is the perfect metaphor for the ways in which mankind and those deemed less mad than others can actually be thought of as even more mad. Do you know which event that is? War, right? A general notion. And so the charnel house by Picasso, a table, and under it, a family killed, right? What's really interesting is that when you look at this painting right off the bat, you can't make that representation. Very, you know, signed Picasso, of course, but the very simple lines, no color, only grays and darker hues of grays and whites. And the fact that you have to search and look to really capture the terror of this image, right? And Picasso, as you know, did many other paintings that showed the madness of war. Siqueiros, Echo of a Scream, once again, just touching on some of the formal elements that make us connect the image to the idea of madness. Ruin, rubble, it seems like an incredibly horrible thing has happened. The central motif is obviously the screaming, face of a baby or a toddler, lost in the middle of this incredible disaster. And of course, there's the echo. There's no way to escape this formally, from any standpoint, composition, color, elements shown. So it's not that we have defined madness and that this painting tells us what that is. It's actually, again, in that nebulous region, right, where formally and stylistically and content-wise, the painting makes us associate a certain act to that category that we reserve for those who used to be called insane. And another one by Otto Dix that I wanted to include only because, again, in its simplicity, brings out the savagery that we associate with it. We recognize this entity, right? Human. There's no doubt about it. So the first step, the first perception is recognition of a representation. But simultaneously, and it's simultaneous, it's not after the fact, you see the grotesque eyes, you see the deformations, you see the lack of any type of sanity that's left in this person. We don't even know if he's alive or dead. Right? Just in that ambiguity, in that zone, with, again, the line work and the almost abstraction of this person, meaning lost, embedded into the background, becoming one with a disaster, that is the powerful suggestion that comes through, again, very artistic techniques, right? And Dix is actually a master at doing this, and he also painted the doctor that we saw at the beginning. That's one of his most representational, least grotesque ones. So this notion of madness used, and I take war, all of these are associated with wars. The Otto Dix is from 1916. It's called Wounded Man. All of them take the central, nebulous ideas that hover around our perception of this phenomenon that we think of as insanity and madness, and use it to represent events and actions that we're engaged with all the time. You could take any contemporary example and come up with pretty good stuff. Madness Reclaimed. Anybody recognize this painting? The painter, the artist? Dali, sure. This one? It doesn't just have one artist. That's a trick. And this is by the Pope of a movement called Surrealism, right? Obviously, we could talk about Surrealism for 2-3 hours in a row. So I'll try to do it in 5 minutes. Surrealism was a movement, and it was a real movement, a real ism. And somebody once asked me, what do you mean by realism? Who gets to decide other than you? And I said, well, I get to decide. But no, that's not true. What I'm calling real versus not real is only self-reclamation, right? Self-identification as a movement, not after the fact by critics or scholars. And surrealism was a movement with manifestos, with tenets, etc. It came right after Dada, as a response to World War I. And what was the response? So here you have logic, coherence, rationality, bringing to us the devastation and the horrors of World War I. So what these guys do, and I say guys because most of them are guys, is respond not by continuing the traditions and showing different faces of events, not by taking the techniques and the methods of representation and switching things around and making us see the world slightly differently, but by actually ushering in new techniques of creation, new ways of creating artifacts in such a way that they champion those non-rational, non-consciously dominated methods of fabrication or creation. You probably have heard very often that surrealism owes a lot to Freud's discoveries, to the unconscious, etc. All of that is true, but it's actually a literary movement at first, and it comes before knowing Freud and his analyses and Jung and all this stuff. So it's not as if, okay, André Breton, the Pope here, who also occasionally does his artwork, reads Freud or reads somebody else and says, okay, this is the theory, I'm going to put it into practice. That's not how it happens. It's a theoretical endeavor in and of itself. So what were some of the things that they did? Surrealists attempted to juxtapose images on canvas, in images, in writing, that don't go together in reality. Right? So Dali becomes a quintessential surrealist. He brings in three frames here, an echo of his involvement in film, if any of you saw the film exhibit with Dali, with men bicycling in different directions with eggs on their heads, a man who seems to be attempting to rape or kill a woman, a hand coming out of the ground with a bloody knife, seems like a big egg in front of Templars, and then all sorts of signs and symbols all in the middle of a desert. In the middle of a desert, you don't see this in reality. Obviously, we don't see these things all together, but we recognize a lot of these images, right? And it's their juxtaposition that throws us off. They came up with new techniques. Have you ever heard of automatic writing, automatic drawing, automatic automatism? At that point, is against conscious and absolutist ways of creating, right? And so, for example, if I were to write a long essay, I would know the beginning, the end, very consciously go line by line, paragraph by paragraph, review it, revise it, blah, blah, blah. One of the things that they ushered in literary terms and then took up in drawing and painting was automatism, meaning I'm going to say a word or say a sentence, you say one, you say one, you say one, we put them all together, what are we going to get? We're going to get four sentences that just came one after another without knowing where they go and what they were. And the idea was that these sentences, these images, are going to make us relate things in ways that we never anticipated. That there's these relationships, unconscious relationships, subconscious relationships between things, words, images that we don't grasp through our conscious mechanism. So this is actually what's called an exquisite corpse as a type of drawing, right? So it's a genre of drawing. It's a particular artifact. What is it? it's I start drawing something just on part of the paper, okay, right here. I fold it over. I leave a little bit of my line so you know where to begin. I hand it out to you. You continue it, right? You fold it. The next person hasn't seen anything of what's been drawn before, and they do their own little fantasy. And at the end, you open the paper, the page, and you are probably going to get a very phantasmagoric scene that does not relate to what you would have in reality, right? This is actually now very often done in schools, and it's very, you know, it's a fun thing to do. It actually is really fun. But it's very ironic that it's fun because this was the anti-art of a time. It was going against the grain of the techniques that were centuries in the making, in that you were taking away control. You were creating collaborative works, right? And here, Breton, who was a theorist and a writer, created his own little, what he called a poem object, with different objects, boxing gloves, keyhole that's made to look like a man, and words in French that you can actually read in different directions. When you see the subtitles, when you see translations, you'll see that it's actually, there's only one translation of it, and you can have multiple translations, multiple directions. All of this to say what? This is not irrationality. It's actually a very rational intellectual endeavor to take away the conscious control, to create automatism, to bring images together that juxtapose, force upon you to see the world in a different way, is a very rational idea, rational endeavor. So you fear very often, oh, it's nonsense. It's definitely not nonsense. It's the reclamation or reclaiming of processes that we did not champion. It's the reclaiming of access to creation of images that are not the normal person's, let's say, mode of behavior because of our education, because of the way we've been formed and designed. In a way, it's the championing of those people who we might call mad. And so if you've never, has anybody ever heard of this book? It's called Nadja, N-A-D-J-A, and it's written by the Pope of Surrealism, Breton. And in it, it's a great mini history of Surrealism, a great theoretical, theoretical, poetical text. But it's also his association with a woman named Nadja. And he's very taken by the way that she interacts with the world, the associations she sees, the ways that she actually takes in the world and brings it back out in artistic creations, and really questions our concepts of rationality, etc. And at one point in the book, I can just read one sentence, he says that he's very sad because they came and told me, there were a few months ago, they told me that Nadja was crazy. Following a few eccentricities to which she had apparently given herself in the hallways of her hotel, she had to be interned at the insane asylum of Vaucluse. Right? And so he goes on and on to really compare methods, techniques, takes on the world that bring in the notion of madness and sanity. Following this, we're in 1945-46, we can tell that there an even bigger reclamation project goes on with what is called Art Brut. Has anybody heard this name? A-R-T-B-R-U-T. This is a work by Jean Dubuffet, D-U-B-U-F-F-E-T. And what he did, as you can see in these images, is that he very consciously, very deliberately championed the art of those he called the insane, the mentally ill, of the child. He purposely went beyond the naive art to create works that are extremely simplistic in their lines, in their naivete, in their methods, etc., and championed them as a response and a very aggressive attack on the culture of the artist, the art world, the exhibitions, etc. Of course, now he's in a multiple collections and he's completely, taken over by those same institutions, which is a very interesting point to consider. But also material-wise, if you ever see one of his works in our collection, he mixed mud and all sorts of stuff with house paint, so his works have great texture. He would often actually draw within the material, so you have very extremely interesting plays with surface, texture, etc. And I want to, in case you're wondering what the definition of art brut, B-R-U-T, was, He meant by the term works executed by those immune to artistic culture, in which imitation has no role, in which their creators take all subjects, materials, transposition, rhythm, etc., from their own individuality and not from the base of classical art or stylish trends. Very problematic definition. Very problematic, because you can argue in many ways that everybody, in essence, is an individual. Everybody's learning from others. But all of that notwithstanding, this became a very important movement as counter to our culture of, you know, absolutism and that careerism, and you do this, then you do that, and then you're officially an artist, and you show here and you show there. And that ushered in what is now called, I'm sure you've heard of this, outsider art. Anybody heard of this term? Outsider art is now just like called painting. So what do? I do paintings. Well, nobody says I do outsider art. It's something you are, right? So I'm an outsider artist, and I do outsider art, right? There's actually a yearly outsider art, what is it? Not a festival, how would you call it? Fair, that's right, excited. Outsider Art Fair in New York City. You go to it, collectors throng to it in order to get these very interesting works by outsider artists. So remember, one of the points of this type of creation was to aggressively attack the traditions and the rituals of this quote-unquote art world, the collectors, etc. And now it's in many ways completely taken in by those very dynamics and those processes. You can argue this in many ways. I've argued this with many people, and you can debate it, its merits, its lack of merits, but what it definitely does is that it brings into the fold the art of people made by people who are not officially part of the culture until they get collected and then they're officially part of the culture. But isn't that the truth with everybody, right? So, great things to consider. And from here, we're going to move on to what you could almost call the second half, which is now a much saner, whoops, pun I'm not sure intended or not, take on this disease. And we're going to call it dementia. We're not going to call it insanity. We're not going to call it madness. We're not going to call it crazy. We're just going to call it dementia, because now it's a medical, clinical term. And we're going to see how it's represented, how its abstractions and representations lead to certain types of actions, right? You probably don't think of this as an artwork, and neither do I. But in a way, it's the representation of the illness. Posters. We have a design collection with posters in it, right? This is the face of Alzheimer's. This is the face of dementia. This is a way that we now define people, categorize them, bring them together, make us see their capabilities, their incapacities, their illnesses, their diagnoses, and then acts that follow that are based on a lot of these representations. Our forms of representations generate actions based on how true or false we deem them to be, right? And we have a legacy of frameworks of representation that we always deal with, culturally, socially, politically. Different places, different times, utilized or thought of certain manifestations and phenomena differently. Meaning if you exhibited certain types of actions, you might become a shaman because you have links to other worlds. And I'm not, you know, simplifying or making light of the thing, but it's very important. I think we forget this all the time, and I try to remind myself all the time. The ways we categorize people is based on a legacy of conceptual frameworks. There he is again. He's still at play, still at work, right? Telling us, diagnosing, thinking. And here's a very contemporary image. This is the guy we see all the time, right? It's really funny because I was in Reno, Nevada about a month and a half ago doing a lecture for 200 medical doctors talking about art and health, its relationships, why, you know, things can happen, et cetera. I'm not sure I convinced all of them, but they seemed a little bit open to it. But what was funny is that all around this majestic lecture hall, there were like 10 feet posters of smiling doctors. all the way from floor to ceiling. You know, they were all smiling, inviting us in. And I kind of kept this slide up for a while on purpose. I didn't know they were going to have posters that long. And so we made the connection between the actual representation of, now we're talking about multiple representations, right? The actual representation of the medical field and its representations of our illnesses. Here we go. Now let's talk about what this is. Does anybody, and somebody was going to tell me what this is.
I thought it was a synapse.
It is. It's a neuron forest. Anybody ever see a real neuron forest? Has anybody seen a neuron forest in reality, in life?
No.
Okay. You're like almost thinking I'm joking, right? Like, what does he mean, neuron forest? Of course I haven't seen a neuron forest. Exactly. I mean, does it exist? I've never even really seen a real forest with trees. I think when I was a kid and now living in a city. But so this is called a neuron forest. And the reason that I say that it's very important is because this is a total abstraction that is actually the representation of phenomena, right? None of us have ever seen it. So when I joked with you that this is a guy you've seen and you're like, of course I've seen him. This is a representation of a real entity. This is not a representation of anything we've seen. This is its own. It's an abstraction playing the role of a representation. And you don't want to let me go into the details about neurotransmitters being released at the edge of these synapses in the neuron forest, do you? Thank you, because I don't. Right, and these are beta amyloids, one of the causes of plaques in what then leads to Alzheimer's disease. Right? But what is Alzheimer's disease? What in reality is it? We see these images. People tell us, well, your activity in this part of your brain. Now, who's ever seen an actual brain? One person over there has seen a brain. You've seen a real brain? Was it a live brain?
No. It was at the
body's
exhibition.
Oh, OK, the body's exhibition. Does that count?
No.
OK, I don't know. Yeah, we'll make it count. I've never seen a brain. All I've seen are images of brains. Right? So again, this notion that these abstractions and the ensemble, here's a healthy brain, here's an advanced Alzheimer's brain, right here, where fluid is in the brain. This is a hippocampus. Thank you. I've learned all this during my years as a, where short-term memory is stored, right? And this is actually very important. You see the difference between these two, right? So of course, modern technology, modern medicine has allowed us to peek into and to understand the functions of certain parts of the brain. We understand associations between degeneration and destruction of some things and manifest behavior. We do understand them, but we're far, far from understanding all the little details and all the subtleties associated with them. This is the way that we represent through a series of abstractions. Plus questionnaires, plus diagnosis, plus people drawing things that they're given, right? All very fascinating, but at the same time, we have to be a little skeptical about it. Now, here's an artistic chronology. This is William Uttermolin. You might have heard of him. In every Alzheimer's presentation and every dementia presentation, his work is shown because it's extremely powerful. This is something he did in 1967, a trained artist. Very skillful, as you can see, extreme amount of detail in the self-portrait, beautifully done, great draftsman, you know, not much to say about the skill and the emotion that comes through. He's diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease in 1995 and agrees to actually make a chronology of this disease through artistic means. This is 1996, 1997, 1998, and 2000. So a very interesting phenomenon occurs, right? We see the actual change and transformation in his style, in his technique, in his ability to do certain things within his chosen artistic medium and within his the essence of his art. But you could also argue that each of these self-portraits is extremely interesting in and of itself. The different colors that are chosen, the different poses, the postures, the elements in the background, the eye, all of these. We can't go into the analysis of each one of them, but each one is fabulous and very fascinating in its own right, and full of complexity, full of subtlety. One thing I heard a month and 3 weeks ago, right before we know we were in LA, and I was a little, sort of made uncomfortable because we had a medical doctor who was presenting on the effects of art and dementia. And next to each of these portraits, she had one word, meaning despair, depression, blah, blah, blah. So in other words, suggesting that each portrait showed one emotion, one thing. I know some people are shaking their heads like, God, oh my God. And that's exactly what my colleagues and I were doing, because it was an oversimplification and overdetermination of the significance and the association of one act, one representation, one form of looking at yourself with one emotion, which is a very dangerous thing to do. Right? So an incredible chronology of the disease through an artistic process. Now here's a fellow who is world-renowned. Does anybody know who this is? Exactly. Okay. And this is from 1952, Woman One. It bears all of the marks of action painting, of advanced abstract expressionism, and the move away from abstract expressionism. The top half, very representational. Right, you see the very domineering face of a woman, the eyes, the very aggressive teeth, large breasts, very powerful, very present, very overpowering and just dominating the scene. And then the bottom part, very abstracted, not sure what's going on. You can make interpretations, but you must also be very open to them. The marks of the action, the act of the painter are there. Harsh gestures, lots of colors. The process of tracing is present within this painting, right? This is a person at full faculty, at the top of his art, right? And the image is actually very representational / abstract and very troubling. Now, de Kooning was diagnosed with what people think was Alzheimer's in the mid-80s, right? And this is from 1985. I'm not going to go into the analysis of this work. And I'll tell you why, because at this point, lots of things have happened. Because this is a world-renowned artist, as soon as there's a diagnosis of an illness, there's this attempt at connecting the transformations in the style, in the colors, in the lines, in everything, and with what's going on in his being. And you read different accounts on different things. You can go either direction. Right? You can go, he's lost touch, it's really not relevant, or to, oh my God, he knew how to limit his work, he knew how to direct his energies, etc. What we do know is that his attention would drift. We know that he needed more assistance and different types of assistance. We know that the concepts of beginning and finishing changed, right? But we also know that he continued to create. Now, if I were to tell you, just for fun, I'm not going to do this. I mean, this is not a real, it's just for fun, okay? Which one of these two was done by a person with a lot of passion and savageness and, a lot of pent-up frustrations or with emotional blah, blah, blah? Which ones would we think it was, right? I'm not going to answer. You can answer just in your own mind. But that's the point. It's very easy to make too easy a connection between styles, and we should stay away from him. And the continuation of creation is really fun. Diagnosis and Liberation, and this is a work actually by Anne Adams, who was a mathematician who had never dabbled in art until she was diagnosed with frontotemporal dementia. And she began, in a frenzy, to create artworks that many now consider to be very worthwhile and of high quality. Now, of course, in parentheses, you should ask, and you're probably asking, who makes those decisions, right? Who decides which outsider artist's art merits inclusion in this or that collection? Who decides whether this has merit because it's just outsider art, because it's fashionable, or because it's good? What does good mean? What does it? All of these questions, believe me, are very debatable, and they're very difficult to answer. And of course, you have different ways of answering them. But for all accounts and purposes, for now, interesting work deemed very of high value for somebody who had never done anything. And here's part of the reasons that we know now with research, neurologists, doctors, have gone into this, have really looked at the patterns, and something like frontotemporal dementia, because of the ways that it affects the brains of some people, based on their experience, their knowledge, their past, their capacities, based on a whole bunch of things, actually liberates in ways that the lack of a disease would not have. Why? Because of the network, because of the circuitry. Whatever it was that made, or whatever it is that makes some people good at one particular skill or act or technique, in this case, is reformulated and regenerated because of the transformations in the circuitry and in the mechanisms and the biology and the chemistry of the brain, right? Now, it also makes you be very antisocial, frontotemporal dementia. It makes you have intense focus. It has a lot of effects, all of which are actually really good for making art. You know, like you're by yourself, you're like isolated, you don't want to talk, you don't, you know, hey, very productive. But you know, that part is, of course, doesn't go necessarily with it. But it's important to consider. And here's what I want to get back to. If you remember everything we were talking before with the surrealists, with Dubuffet and outsider art and Art Brut, they were in very conscious, modulated ways attempting theoretically to create ways and methods through which you could actually fashion artifacts of great merit artistically. And what are those merits? In my opinion, works that make you see the world differently, works that make you impose upon you to revise and review your own assumptions about the way things work, about the world. And so with people who have certain issues, illnesses, or whatever it is that we diagnose, they might actually not have to go through that theoretical process because their circuitry, the way that they function, actually makes them have a direct access to those processes and to those methods that create those types of artifacts that we call art. So I think it's a big mistake to think an artist is this, goes through this steps, becomes that, and then it's good or bad based on what I think or what somebody else thinks. I think we have to go through the path of the dialogical interaction with a work of art. Perception of the viewer is what matters. And if we take that, we open the field of possibilities immensely. So I'm not surprised, and many of my colleagues and others are not surprised, that people with certain illnesses and certain transformations in their brain create very interesting things, because that's kind of how it works, you know? And of course, I have to come to our beloved program at MoMA. Knowing what we know, knowing about the possibilities that people with diagnosed dementia, with Alzheimer's disease, the way that their brains function in some ways, we know some manifest reactions, right? We know what happens with people when they get Alzheimer's disease to a very limited degree. Short-term memory loss, for example, lack of certain confidence, focus, etc. But there's a million things we don't know, to the point where even people from the Alzheimer's associations and others acknowledge the fact that you could very potentially have many different types of dementias under the umbrella of what is now Alzheimer's, because it's manifested differently among people, right? And so what we do at MoMA, I'll tell you very quickly, we have interactive gallery conversations, discussions with people diagnosed with early stage to middle stage Alzheimer's disease and other dementia, and their caregivers. We've been at this 3-4 years. We've learned a lot. We've changed a lot of our mechanisms and processes and strategies and methods for creating interactive possibilities, right? And we know now many of its benefits. You don't want me to go down the list of benefits, but among them are mood changes, are an acknowledgement of the possibilities that are still left with that person, self-respect, knowing that you still have a lot to contribute, so possibilities for socialization, right? Meaningful experience, extremely important. But more than that, and that's where it fits within this lecture, because that's great, right? This is a mission of a museum, to provide these possibilities. It's the insights provided by folks within this program because of the transformations and the changes in their brain, right? They provide insights into works of art when looking at and discussing them that we, trained in our ways of looking and thinking, might not get into. They generate discussions and interpretations and associations that otherwise might not happen. We have not gotten into right now with this program in creating artworks, but we've done it many, many years in other programs. And everything that I talked about before in creating art is, of course, still valid with this population. And it's not by chance that I picked this image with our participants and my colleague Gordon Sasaki, because they're in front of Cézanne, the bather, right? An icon of modern art and a symbol of the beginning, of new beginnings, right? And I think what really this program tells us at the end of our lecture here is that there's a field of possibilities with people, that easy categorization, convenient ways of making people fit into, you know, places and things and events and categories again, is probably convenient, but does not allow us to gain all that we have to gain for ourselves as educators, as a society, as a community, and as individuals, right? So it's a real epistemological concern, right? It's a real issue of knowledge about how we function, how we go. On Monday, somebody said in this room, in something like 2 minutes from now, when we were going through questions and answers, they mentioned somebody, I forget the name, a scholar who had gone all the way back through history and determined which artists had bipolar disease and made a big category of each one and how she determined that they had bipolar disease. I was skeptical. I was like, well, I wouldn't really want that, you know? But then I thought about it between Monday and now, and I thought, I actually would want that. I would welcome that. But you know what? Nobody can actually make those claims. That's the problem. I wouldn't mind if one point we could say, well, you, because of your brain chemistry and the way it works, you're going to end up using blue and red and yellow, and you're going to make this type of line. You're going to represent our doctors in this way, and you're going to take this kind of photograph because of this. Of course we can't do that, right? Because the complexity and the network of stuff that's happening between experience, your individuality, all of the functions of the brain, the different areas of the brain, all of these are not resolved, right? Including the definitions of art. And I mean, we're not sure where to begin in discussing art and dementia and the possibilities of the brain in creating and understanding art if we don't have a clear definition of art. And the art's definition is constantly changing. One of the new definitions of art is to constantly redefine art. So if we're constantly creating works that redefine art as we know it, how can we decide what the brain and art does? I've read many, many research papers, etc., on art and the brain, and they all make the classic mistake. They, you know what they take as art? Painting and sculpture. And they go from there, and you, of course, elaborate all sorts of, you know, very fancy issues, but then it doesn't work. This, by the way, is an arteriogram of the blood vessels in the brain, right? It's possibility. It's about technology, contemporary knowledge, about all that could happen. And this is a photograph by W. Eugene Smith, that who you know, and it's called Insane Stockade at Dr. Schweitzer's in 1954. I don't want to end on a sad note or a downer, but I wanted to end with this because, again, coming back to photography, it's power to represent, but at the same time, it's power to point to itself as an artifice and a creation of an image of the world. That's number one. But number two, symbolically speaking, there is the invisibility, right? Marked by the two hands, represented by presence, is absence, is non-participation, is marginalization, completely cut off from us literally and symbolically. And the idea is to really think of art and its possibilities, the fact that it integrates within its definition and its processes the notion of seeing the world in new ways, the notion of redefining itself, the notion of always becoming something, that is sort of, I think, what we need to be left with. And we should be weary of categories, weary of identifications, easy identifications, and allow possibilities and allow the range of wondrousness and magic. I know I'm sounding a little corny, but it is magical what can actually happen when you allow all forms of expression to have legitimacy and validity and to then respond to them through perception. I want to just end with one note. We've been talking to a lot of people, a lot of, you know, folks with dementia, and always they tell us about meaningful experiences, etc. And one poignant thought that one of our favorite people says is that as soon as I got dementia, as soon as I got Alzheimer's, everybody keeps saying goodbye to me. You know, I wake up in the morning or whatever, everybody thinks it's the long goodbye, right? As soon as you're diagnosed, the long goodbye. I'm going to do this. They feel bad for you. They don't want to talk to you because they feel sorry for you. And he said, I'm sick of people playing bingo for me. I don't want to play bingo. And number two, I don't want people to say goodbye all the time, literally and metaphorically. I want them to say hello. So what I'm going to leave you with is a literal and metaphorical hello. So, yeah, hello. So we have about 5 minutes for questions and comments and answers. Yes?
Are you looking for volunteers for...
The Meet Me at MoMA program? Yeah, this is a great propaganda machine. That's what a few people asked me also on Monday. At this point, actually, we have many people who are assisting and helping us. And I think I don't think at this point it would help us to have more volunteers, to be honest with you.
I've been inquired before and they said that they've given me a very negative,
unmagical
answer.
The unmagical answer. I know, because you know the volunteer situation doesn't even go through us. I don't know if you know that. It goes through the museum. Always blame the museum when it's not right. But it's true. Yeah.
What about the possibility of those hands actually penetrating and you reaching and catching one? I mean, I think we're locked into not being able to receive this because it seems to be a wall and a closed thing. But I see it as an open space with somebody behind there.
Yes.
Yeah. Perceive it differently.
Absolutely. I think you're right. I mean, I think in our interpretation of this particular artwork, we can read a lot
good
of what you're...
Piece,
yeah.
Why.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I think that anything that does that is a good
yeah.
piece. I agree with you. Yeah.
You said the program has been going on for 3-4 years.
Yeah.
What have you noticed in terms of long-term reactions as the disease progresses?
Right.
I don't know if you go back to works of authors you've seen.
We do.
How change in perception?
Sure, great question. Number one, the one good thing is that most people who come once keep coming back. So they really like the program, and I'm really not propagandizing, but we've done a million studies, focus groups, et cetera, and the range of benefits and meanings that it brings makes people come back. That's number one. So they do come back. We don't have an absolutist approach where we think, okay, so this person has been coming for 3 months, so they're at a different stage, so let's go see that work again and reminisce or think about. We don't do that. But we have seen all sorts of progressions. One is that when people keep coming back, really in front of the works, they almost acquire a new personality. They talk more, they're very involved, they're very engaged. Their caregivers, family members very often then tell us that they really behave differently here. Over time, we see that behavior change. Sometimes, again, they're more withdrawn, they're less verbal, but they're connecting in different ways. They actually still keep coming back. Right. One of the sad parts is that there is no cure to the disease. It does progress, and we do see it. By no means is this a cure, magical cure in any way. So we do see that progression, and very often, if people had started at a later beginning stage, let's say, then over 2 years, we're going to see the involvement get less and less pronounced, their engagement less and less, verbal. Yeah.
I guess my question is more to the the issue that you raised of the reconstructing worlds through art, you know, I guess my interest would be in whether or not that reconstruction, that ability to decode and to, you know, apply your own experience to a figure of paint, that would interest me in how that changes. As your brain changes.
That's right. I mean, that's a great question, and I could tell you anecdotally that with Mr. X and Mr. Y, I noticed, because, you know, I do a lot of these groups myself, that 2 years ago and a year and 6 months ago and a year and 2 months ago, I could chart the differences there and whether they're becoming less literal, they're becoming more liberal in the associations and interpretations. That happens very often with people that we didn't know, who are at a middle stage. They already start at a very free interpretive associative level, and then it goes even further. But we don't have an actual study of that. You know, fascinating study would be to take a person or six people from the moment they come in and chart their responses over 3 years and see what happens. We've done one study, and it's one of the only studies ever in this field, and what that study charts is the effects, based on very interesting tools, of first-time visitors to MoMA, right before, during, and after. And, you know, these scientifically driven studies are so justifiably so, very elaborate. And so just that one attempt at seeing what happens during a visit and what are its effects after the visit took a long time and a lot of person power and hours. But that is another great study, fascinating study. But there's a whole bunch of them. Yes?
How has your involvement with the program affected your response to art?
That's a great question. And I have a good answer, but it's coming up. Number one, it confirmed my theoretical approach. My theoretical approach has always been that art is actually almost like a status. It's not a thing. And that it depends on the relationship between a viewer or a perceiver or a reader or an audience and itself. So the social context, etc., of course it matters and you can study it if you have the tools. But in terms of what makes it artistic, that's one. So because people respond in great interpretive ways, it's confirmed that for me. Number two, it's also made me think that there's another way of decoding works of art, which is collecting a lot of data from a lot of different people, rather than just have one person write, you know, what about that work is interesting, which is their musings. But it's also made me really rethink the social and political nature of museums and institutions that exhibit art, what those missions are, in non-corny kind of ways. You know, and that's a very important differentiation, because of course our mission is to provide programming and to design and create innovative programming, which everybody in our department does. But beyond that, I think we have a possibility to redefine and get insights about what art is, how we can make it, how we can circulate it, all the elements of the art world. I think this program allows us insight into. And lastly, but there's many more, but things that I can think of right off the bat, I think it's the relationships between brain, experience, arts, the mechanisms of reading them, the chemistry, are fascinating. And I can tell you, I think I've read a lot of it. And we're here, we have so little information. And there's a lot of very enthusiastic people who want to make big conclusions. But you just can't, they're flawed. The conclusions are flawed, and it's a very fascinating arena to explore artistically, in and of itself, and scientifically and research-wise, et cetera. So I think there'll be much, much more of this. Yeah?
Just quickly, you talked about actually making art.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, have you started that, or is it too complicated?
No, it's not complicated. Many other programs actually do, across the country, do art making with people with Alzheimer's or dementia. We used to, and we continue to do outreach, so we go to assisted living facilities, nursing homes, and we do that. We're not necessarily sure that everybody in that unit has Alzheimer's or dementia. It's a mix of things. We do partner with organizations where we know, and there's 6 people or 8 people or 10 people doing it. And we're going to create a program specifically from our participants at Meet Me at MoMA to actually create artwork. when we very initially started this, we also brought in and started to do drawings in the galleries or exercises, and we noticed that a lot of people didn't want to be put on the spot. They didn't want to engage. In fact, I've worked with many adults in their 30s and 40s and 50s, and they don't want to go near doing drawings and thinking because they're like, oh, I don't know how to draw. They get very self-conscious, etc. So we thought that the best way to do it is to have self-selecting people. So we have almost 200 people, 250, 300 who come to our programs regularly. And among them, they've already told us they're interested in art workshops and art studios. And some people have been and continue to be artists. Some people have, you know, have new interest in art. I have this ongoing dialogue with a caregiver of a person who has Alzheimer's. And just 2 days ago, he was telling me about the changing notions of beginning and finishing and assistance or, you know, helping, guiding. He's trying to help her, guide her, but he doesn't want to intervene too much. Or what does that mean, et cetera? And funnily enough, I was just, you know, doing research on de Kooning. And the issue was, you know, none of this is relegated to people with Alzheimer's. Anybody here who's ever done an artwork in general, the issues of beginning and ending and continuing and assisting and being assisted and being influenced, all those are constant preoccupations. So instead of, I think that's a great point to almost end on, instead of thinking, well, okay, so we never had those and now it's an issue, that actually shows us how those things have always been issues. There is an insight gained by disability, right? The fact that not knowing when to finish and when to end and the changing nature of assistantship in an extreme way makes us conscious that those are questions that are always there, but that we don't think about them in the same ways, right? And I think a lot of things like that happen. These are insights gained for me as an artist, right? For somebody else that I didn't put in my 5 bullet points because I didn't think of it, that are gained from these things. What are the issues? And how can we learn from them as individuals, as groups, as artists, as scientists that allow... You know, it's the question of almost... I'm going a little bit over here. But, you know, the savant phenomenon, right? When somebody cannot do anything else, but they can do something incredibly well. Well, that should lead us to research and insights into certain things, and we've done that. Now, I'm not comparing this to that. But in terms of the recircuitry of the changing brain and person, it should allow us many types of insights. All right, guys, thanks. And if anybody's interested, I did bring cards this time.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.